I'm Sinan Aral, and this is The Digital Insider, where we get to the real hard science behind the digital economy and explore the latest trends in digital business and society with the world's leading thinkers and doers. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Digital Insider. My guest today is Frances Haugen, also known as the Facebook whistleblower. She's a radical advocate for accountability and transparency in social media and has been very vocal recently in her criticism of Facebook and other social media platforms. In 2019, she was recruited to Facebook to be the lead product manager on the Civic Misinformation Team, which dealt with issues related to democracy and misinformation. Later, she also worked on counterespionage at the company. Frances became increasingly alarmed by the choices the company was making in prioritizing their own profits over public safety and putting people's lives at risk. As a last resort and at great personal risk, Frances made the decision to blow the whistle on Facebook. The initial reporting was done by the Wall Street Journal in what became known as the Facebook Files. Frances has testified in front of the US Congress, the UK and EU parliaments, the French Senate and National Assembly, and has engaged with lawmakers internationally on how best to address the negative externalities of social media.
Explosive whistleblower testimony.
Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower.
Frances Haugen.
Facebook whistleblower. Frances Haugen.
The former Facebook employee claiming the social media giant knew its apps could cause harm to some of its youngest users.
I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. Almost no one outside of Facebook knows what happens inside of Facebook. The company intentionally hides vital information from the public, from the U.S. government, and from governments around the world.
Frances has also filed a series of complaints with the U.S. federal government related to how Facebook, now called Meta, that claim that the company has been misleading the public and investors on how it handles issues like climate change, misinformation, and hate speech, as well as the impact of its services on the mental health of children and young adults.
And unfortunately, in the case of teen girls and things like self-harm, they develop these feedback cycles where children are using Instagram as to self-soothe, but then are exposed to more and more content that makes them hate themselves. The choices being made inside of Facebook are disastrous for our children, for our public safety, for our privacy, and for our democracy.
I'm inspired by Frances's story, and I'm so excited to share it with you on today's episode. Please let us know what you think by leaving a review and rating after you listen, and don't forget to subscribe. I hope you enjoy my conversation with the Facebook whistleblower, Frances Haugen. I want to start with a personal question, which is that as you're, you know, nobody, including yourself, thinks about their career and says, well, you know, I'm really planning to grow up and be a whistleblower. That's my big aim in life. Yeah. Right. So this is not something that's not a decision that someone takes lightly. It's not something that someone aspires to. It's someone, it's something that someone sort of feels that they are forced to do or called to do, not something that they aim to do. And so I just want to hear from you in your personal experience. How'd you decide you needed to become a whistleblower? What motivated you? What scared you in that moment as you were making that decision? What was it like emotionally prepping for months from the inside for doing what would eventually become such a grand and important gesture, but also extremely public and probably excruciatingly intense as well?
You have a really important insight there, which is that no one sets out to be a whistleblower. Like I like to joke, like it's not a plan B. It's like a plan D, E, F, G, H. It's one of these things where I feel really, really lucky that my path to being a whistleblower involved living with my parents. So during COVID, I went and lived with my parents, both because I was worried about them. Also, I have dietary restrictions and, you know, they were willing to go gluten-free to protect my health. And so it was kind of, we both protected each other. And my previous housemates, that was going to be a difficult thing for us all to live in the same environment for a long period of time. And my mother is an Episcopal priest. So she used to be a scientist. She actually did a postdoc at MIT, little known fact, way back in the 70s. And but she's a priest today. She's a priest in a rural parish in Iowa. And I think part of the reason why a lot of whistleblowers really struggle by the time they come out is living with a secret is really, really hard, especially when that secret, you think either people's health, their lives, their well-being is on the line. And I came forward because, you know, a lot of us think about social media and it feels maybe even frivolous, right? It's like about looking at pictures of cats. It's about pictures of your breakfast. The reality is that because Facebook subsidized usage of its platform in many emerging markets, there's like a billion people today who the internet and Facebook are synonymous, right? Like they don't get to choose to leave Facebook because for the majority of languages in the world, 80 or 90% of the content in their language is only available on the internet, is only available on Facebook. So it's less a question of like, am I choosing to use Facebook versus I'm choosing to use Twitter? No. It's like, I either get to use the internet or I don't get to use the internet, right? And I think of myself as pretty well read. And even I, before I joined Facebook, had not thought about the implications of Facebook's safety strategy and the safety investments they make, the idea that it they're killing people in places that are fragile around the world. Right. So Myanmar is a well-documented genocide from 2016 and 2017 that was actively done using Facebook. And the State Department in the United States only declared that a genocide like last week. Right. The UN has in great detail detailed how Facebook's failure at linguistic equity, you know, the idea that it doesn't matter what language you speak, you deserve to be safe. And Facebook invested so little in Myanmar, even though it knew this was an area that was fragile, that there was only one Burmese speaker available in the company, right? And so when things started going sideways, even though that person was ringing the bell, they were so far down in the organization and there wasn't avenues for surfacing this or an interest to hear it, that it fell on deaf ears. And so I looked at what was emerging in Ethiopia. I was looking at what I was learning through my work with both civic misinformation and these things called adversarial harmful networks. And I came to the conclusion that I thought earnestly that, and I still feel this way, that there are tens of millions of lives on the line over the next 20 years, that Myanmar and Ethiopia are the opening chapter. They're not the end. And that there are major geopolitical consequences because I think what's going to happen is Facebook is going to see a series of these situations where it just escalates because their algorithms give the most reach to the most extreme content, right? Because it generates the most interactions. We're going to see more of these events build up, and we may see things like more countries turning to a China-like model of internet suppression because Facebook, the internet, has let them down so much. And so I felt at some point I had a manager at Facebook who I really valued as a leader and as like a people manager, as like a person who cultivated people. And he said to me once, "We don't solve problems alone; we solve problems together." And I just think it's just one of those sentiments that I always carry with me. And at some point, when Facebook dissolved Civic Integrity, which was the part of the company that was charged explicitly with making sure Facebook was a positive force in the world, I came to the conclusion that Facebook wasn't going to solve this problem alone, that the only path forward was we needed to get the public involved so we could solve it together.
Yeah, I think this was such an important moment in this conversation because it really did. I think one of the major themes of our conversation today and in general should be about transparency. And I think that transparency is something that I've been hitting on for a long time. And it took somebody from the outside to demonstrate to the world the lack of transparency. It's hard to do a non-existence proof or an existence proof for something that you don't know what there is there. So, you know, the big sort of whistleblowing action is the release of the documents and then the fantastic way that you have engaged in the conversation afterwards is also extremely important. I want to ask, of those 10,000 documents, what do you think is the most important document or the most important set of documents, the main themes in those documents that you think are the most important?
So I would say the most important thing, like I'm going to kind of summarize together a collection of documents. The most important thing for people to understand is that Facebook is a very opaque system. Like compared even to other social media companies like Twitter, it is substantially less transparent. So in the case of Twitter, Twitter puts out a fire hose with 1/10 of all the tweets. Anyone who wants to research it can. And a huge number of influence operations Facebook are caught using data for Twitter. You know, they find a network on Twitter, they go and they find the same account names on Facebook. Twitter sends the IP addresses over to Facebook, they find the same problematic accounts. One of the Facebook has taken advantage of the fact that it knew that no one could call them on, like no one could definitively say, this is what's happening on Facebook. They took advantage of that situation to frame how we even discuss addressing the problems of social media in a way that could not be resolved. So Facebook came out and said, this is a freedom of speech issue, right? The only thing for us to discuss is, are we censoring too much? Are we censoring too little? How can we be responsible about censoring? They formed the Facebook Oversight Board, which only has a remit of focusing on those censorship decisions. And they did this very intentionally. There's a number of documents in there where they go and they survey users who've had their content taken down. And Facebook knows when you get censored, it drives you crazy, right? At the same time, Facebook declined to ever let us talk about all the non-content-based ways we could be dealing with these safety problems. For example, Twitter requires you to click on a link before you reshare it. It sounds like a really small thing, but it's the difference of 10 or 15% of misinformation, right? If we said, hey, Alice wrote something, it landed in Bob's newsfeed, friend. He reshared it, now it's in Carol's newsfeed, friend of friend. Lands in Dan's newsfeed, beyond friend of friends. Imagine if Dan had to choose to spread that content or not. He had to copy and paste it in order to spread it. Has he been oppressed? Has he been censored? I don't think so. All we've said is we value human decisions, autonomy, thought, enough that we want a human in the loop. We don't want an instinct in the loop. We want a human in the loop. And that little bit of friction, giving people a chance to breathe before they reshare, that is the same impact as the entire third-party fact-checking system. And it really, really aggravates me when Mark Zuckerberg goes on these podcasts and goes, you know, I've learned a really hard life lesson this year, which is sometimes you have to be unpopular to stand up for what you believe in. And I'm like, oh my God, like you have options that don't infringe on freedom of speech. And you choose to not invite the public in to discuss what are the options that we should be pursuing.
I think that those two topics are so important. So This distinction between speech and algorithmic reach, right? The idea that you have the right to say whatever you want, but do you also have the right and or the detriment of being either promoted extensively or demoted? That's an algorithmic and policy / code choice, which really does determine through objective functions of the algorithms, what gets promoted, what doesn't get promoted. And then that second point, friction, which is a topic that we have talked a lot about here at the IDE, and we have made sort of a centerpiece. I think that really is a sword that cuts through that free speech debate. The idea isn't about who gets to say what, it's about pause. So a lot of our research shows that when you pause and have people move into a critical thinking and reflective mode, for example, research by Dave Rand shows that reduces the belief in and desire to spread false news. So it's a cognitive technical solution that has nothing to do really with speech.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask you, I know one topic that you've been really interested in recently.
And actually, can we touch on one more little thing there?
Please.
Part of why it's so important for us to talk about these product choices. So this is like, should you have to click on a link to reshare it? You know, should you be able to spam out to 10 groups at the same time the same thing? Or should you have to do that as 10 separate actions? These are choices Facebook made for business reasons that had huge externalities on the public. When we choose to look at product choices, that helps with linguistic equity, right? The idea, instead of focusing on censorship, where you have to rewrite your AI over and over again to fit each language. And right now, Facebook doesn't invest in the vast majority of languages in the world. Product changes make sure that every language is safe, not just the ones that have, more than 100 million people.
Well, that's a really, really good point. So just to paraphrase, you're saying that if I make an algorithmic choice about friction and or reach, it applies across platforms, regardless of the amount of investment. I mean, across languages.
Across languages.
Regardless of the amount of investment I make in that language. But when I make a censorship policy choice, it's implemented based on reading what's said and deciding whether it should or should not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought that up. And I wanna sort of pivot slightly, but along the same line to a topic that has been really important to you, which is the effect of social media on children, on kids, on teens, and so on. And we know that product choices are having important impacts there as well. So what do you think is the effect of social media on kids? What do we know? What do the platforms know? And what should we be doing or thinking about that?
So Facebook, when the initial reporting from the Wall Street Journal came out, they front ran the Wall Street Journal when they went to go publish a very small subset of the documents that were used in their reporting. So the Wall Street Journal was going to publish 6 documents. They gave Facebook a chance to comment, and Facebook promised they wouldn't try to front run the news. And so they did the night before. They rushed out a subset of those documents. So they published themselves maybe 2 or 3 of the 6 documents. And they were the ones with the smallest sample sizes. So they said, all this research is taken out of context. Look at these. They have such small sample sizes. But the ones they didn't publish, like the top sample size out of those documents had 100,000 people in it. And it was about problematic use, which is, in other words, addiction. And it found that the highest rate of problematic use is in 14-year-olds, right? I think it's really, really important to remember that maybe the median kid can safely use social media. I'm not a psychologist. I can't really weigh in on that. But I can tell you as an algorithmic specialist that these algorithms concentrate harms. They concentrate harms in the form of, if you have a vulnerability, if you have a rabbit hole you go down, they suck you towards that spot. Because the algorithms don't have context. They don't know if a topic is good for you or bad for you. All they know is some topics really draw people in. Mm. And unfortunately, some of those topics are things like self-harm. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that younger brains have more impulse control issues. And let's be honest, it's really hard being a teenager. So let's say you get into a doom scrolling loop where the way you are self-soothing is you're dissociating. You know, you're sitting there and it's 9 o'clock, it's 10 o'clock, it's 11 o'clock. It just keeps getting later. If the thing that is making you anxious is the content you're looking at, and in the case of Instagram, like Facebook's own researchers say, Instagram is meaningfully worse for kids than other forms of social media in that TikTok is largely about performance, about humor, about doing things with your friends. Snapchat is about faces and augmented reality. Reddit is at least vaguely about ideas, but Instagram is about social comparison and bodies. So let's say you're dissociating, you're doom scrolling. You know, Facebook has a lot of things they could do to say, we value your autonomy and your dignity. You know, we know we have a product that people get stuck in these loops on. You know, they could say, hey, tell us when you want to go to bed. We'll slowly slow down the product for 30 minutes before then, right? Because they know with hackers that if they slow the product down, you know, eventually the product gets slow enough that the hackers stop messing around. They could help you taper off and it would just be less attractive towards the end of the night. There are things they could do to respect our autonomy and our dignity. And because they have trouble acknowledging that these are addictive products, they have trouble even exploring or having discussions about those topics.
So I want to be clear about the definition of a phrase that you use, problematic use.
Problematic use.
Can you define that for us and also show us where that phrase comes from and what it means and what its context is?
So I don't know the original context and research. I only know it from the Facebook documents. So at Facebook, the definition of problematic use is if you meet 2 criteria. So the first is if when asked, you say, can you control your usage of this app? You say, no, I can't control this usage. And the second is when asked, is your usage so bad that it's meaningfully hurting your health, your social life, your academics, your workplace? If you can say it's hurting me in one of these ways, the combination of those two things means problematic use in the Facebook context. Okay. And what's kind of crazy about that is the fact that it peaks at 14, I think is actually kind of remarkable. Because like, think about how many 14-year-olds are self-aware enough to admit that they can't control themselves, or are self-aware enough to admit that it's hurting like their schoolwork, right? Or it's hurting their physical health.
Got it. So when we're talking about that document mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. did front run, but part of yeah. the six, the 100,000, that's yeah. a survey where people mm-hmm. of different ages are answering a battery of questions, including, yep. Can I not control my use? And does it harm me in one of these yep. ways? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there were also some of these, the Wall Street Journal paired some of the things that they revealed with you, mm-hmm. with some of their own sort of, doom scrolling investigations where they went on and saw, you know, what happens if I, you know, watch a certain type of content and I keep watching and so on. How do those two things go together, and what kind of picture?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. About how to use social media. Yeah.
So a study that has been repeated across a number of contexts to Facebook. So I found four separate examples of this. There might be more. Is Facebook has come out before. And like last spring, Nick Clegg did a very eloquent piece called It Takes Two to Tango. Nick Clegg had the audacity of coming out and saying, we're hearing a lot about how our algorithms are leading people to bad content, but let's level with each other here. You chose your friends, you chose your interest, it takes two to tango. And what I find so outrageous about this article is by the time it was written, there had been four separate examples, at least four, where people had gone and taken brand new accounts, either on Facebook or on Instagram. I'll tell you about the Instagram one because of the context. Took a brand new account on Instagram. They started out and they just did some very centrist interests, like healthy eating, healthy food, healthy recipes. And then no friends, no other interests. And then all they did was click on the first couple pieces of content each day and follow any like hashtags that were recommended to them. And, you know, just doing that 10 pieces of content a day over the course of a couple of weeks, you ended up being led to eating disorder content. It's stuff that glorifies eating disorders. And so you can ask what happened here. So Facebook's algorithms don't have context, right? They're just scanning for what's the next piece of content you're most likely to engage with. And that means you can end up in a situation where there is a bias towards extreme content, right? So they saw this again in places like political contexts, where you could take people with center left or center right interests and, you know, doing the exact same thing. So new account, just click on the content, join groups that are suggested. Within, you know, 2 weeks, you start getting to things like on the right, like white genocide, right? And on the left, you get to things after like 3 weeks, like we should kill conservatives. Right. Mm. So these are not isolated instances. It is a thing about engagement-based ranking, where unless you're thinking about other ways of kind of cooling it down, the algorithms will keep giving priority to more extreme content.
So two questions come to mind there. And you are definitely speaking in our wheelhouse here. We actually think we've got a research team working on this, that the studies that are done that have very few signals for the algorithm, the ones that don't have the friends and don't have the prior history and so on, mm-hmm. Provide a lot less for the recommendation system to go on when making recommendations. So we think that a more comprehensive investigation of that is warranted. But here's my question. When I speak to psychologists and social psychologists in this area, and I've spoken to many who have looked at the various research, there is a notion that sort of the survey-based approach to determining mental health impacts is not very reliable, there isn't, and going back to your point about transparency, and just to reflect that again, that there isn't a sort of well-established understanding of exactly what the mental health impacts are of social media for kids. So the question is, What do you think are the studies that we need to do to determine whether and what mental health impacts there are on kids?
I think one really interesting, so there's a question of there are the studies that can be done with Facebook's cooperation, and there are the studies that can be done without Facebook's cooperation. So we can start with the ones where Facebook won't cooperate because, you know, past track record, they're probably not going to cooperate. I think it'd be really interesting to go in there and get a rate limiter app, right? Like there are these apps out there where you can set budgets and say, you know, I'm going to do 20 minutes a day on this app. I'm going to do an hour on this app. And like, just do a really basic kind of dose response study, right? Come in and just have one cohort gets an hour, another cohort gets 2 hours, another cohort gets 3 hours, another cohort gets 4 hours. And it needs to be the kind of app that can phone home so you can see if people actually circumvent it, right?
Can we recruit you to be a research scientist at MIT? That sounds like a very, very good study that I think hopefully my team is taking notes on what we should be doing next.
Right, because I think there's this really interesting thing of like, I really want to do a study that is in a social context where I want to go into a high school and I want to survey all the kids in the high school and say, how many hours a day do you use social media? How does it make you feel? How many hours a day do you want to use it? And then I want to do some games because we can do games that help kids understand network versus individual solutions, help them understand the business model, help them understand the costs of individual action versus collective action, all these things, right? Because some problems like this one, that you really have to address a community. An individual is actually a very high cost for an intervention. And then at the end of the week, come in and say to the kids, like, now you've learned all this stuff, we're going to show you the results of the survey we did. You say you use 6 hours a week and you are 6 hours a day or 4 hours a day, whatever the number is, it's probably much higher than you think. You want to use it for 90 minutes a day. Hey, we're gonna give you one last chance. Whatever number you say, we're gonna go to the PTA and say, you, the kids, chose this number. And your parents are gonna, like, whoever opts in, your parents can put rate limiters on your phones. What number do you wanna use? Right? And just do a follow-up study where you're like, how many kids keep the rate limiters on and for how long? You know, I'm pretty sure you're gonna see a higher level of compliance if you do a network level intervention instead of an individualized intervention.
You are really speaking our language now, because we are very much about the networked interventions. We believe in this idea of social proof and this idea of, you know, that communities do things differently than individuals.
Yeah, totally.
Differently than individuals. So just the follow up. What if
Facebook- and actually I want to add one more line, please, on that. And it's also a question about agency. And about respecting the agency and dignity of teenagers, right?
Yeah,
that,
absolutely.
That, you know, lots of studies have shown that when you value a patient, when you value the person who's getting care as in a person who has agency and dignity, they're more likely to comply, right? And they're more likely to have buy-in. So,
yeah. So just the follow-up, what if Facebook would cooperate? What if I to Facebook and I could say, hey, independent MIT collaborative study.
Totally.
Collaborate with us, you know, and publicly. Sure. What should our study be on the question of mental health for kids? Yeah.
So Facebook's done research internally. So I know you're currently saying, like, you don't believe that when we ask people how's your mental health doing or your body image, like, it's not accurate. But let's imagine we cared about what people said, right? Facebook's done studies where they ask people, like, you know, do you think Instagram is hurting your body image? Do you think that it, you know, it's hurting your mental health or whatever? And then they go and look at what content people engage with, right? They have topical models and they can see, like, what's the difference in terms of, like, what content are people engaging with? And I think there's some really interesting studies where if you could get Facebook to cooperate over a period of time, you know, you could pull people regularly on what their mental health state is, you know, maybe once a week. I don't know. It could be an ongoing thing. And you could see, like, when people get depressed, do they then get more drawn towards certain kinds of content? Because let's be honest, every single day, our mental states go up and down. So you have some variability there. And seeing, like, you know, how does that change, like, what content you receive then the following day, right? Because one of the questions we're asking here is around, do people reset to a baseline? Are people resilient? Are they self-healing? Or do the algorithms give them emotional inertia? Where, like, you might have had a bad day and you might have engaged with more depressing stuff, does the algorithm follow that down mood to the next day? Because I'll give you a real quick example. I was very, very ill for a number of years, profoundly ill. I had to relearn to walk. I still have really bad chronic pain in my legs. That's part of why I live in Puerto Rico, is because the only time I'm not in pain is when I'm warm. Right. And I as I emerged from being in pain and suffering for a long period of time, when I started like feeling better, part of it moving to Puerto Rico, I remember looking at my Netflix recommendations and be like, God, my Netflix recommendations are so bad. Like, they're all depressing. And like, I would love, like, I keep contemplating, I should just reset all my recommendations, because like, when I look at my friend's Netflix, like I moved into a shared house and I was like, wow, their Netflix accounts are so much better than my Netflix account. So this question of like, what is the emotional inertia, or should we be pulling people back to the baseline? Is it like, what's the role of that? And I think there's some really interesting experiments that we should do around that question of how do we make sure that algorithms aren't making it hard for us to be our best selves?
Great, great advice. So you've talked obviously at length to legislatures, to Congress. You're in Europe right now, and thank you for joining from Europe. So I want to shift gears to legislative action. What do you think are the most important areas of legislative action that needs to be taken, and why? What specific laws need to be passed? What cases need to be brought? Which ones are the most important, do you think?
So I'm gonna give you a kind of disappointing answer, which is, I think part of how we got here today was there weren't enough people at the table, right? That you have maybe 300, 400 people in the world that are algorithmic experts at these kinds of systems at a great enough level of depth, who also understand the interactions between product choices and these algorithms. You know, 300 or 400 people shouldn't dictate how the consciousness of humanity is directed. And so I hold back from being like, hey, here's 30 things you can do tomorrow, right? Because I think that's a system problem. But the two things I always advocate for, and I think these are like, have to do them tomorrow. One is we need mandated, auditable transparency, right? That might mean access to raw data for researchers. It might mean regular aggregate data that's available to the public, sampled data that's regularly available to the public. Right now, Facebook does a most viewed content report that I think is one of the most deceptive pieces of corporate communication that's out there right now, because it shows you the top 20 pieces of content, but only in the United States, which is the place that they have invested the vast majority of their third-party fact-checking budget, the vast majority of their safety budget. And so the fact that they've only shown us the most manicured part of the data, and then only in the United States, which is like 9% of users, I think is, given I have seen the most viewed content in the at-risk countries. So these are the countries that Facebook considers at risk of genocide. And if we saw that content, we'd say, this is immoral, right? Like, you, the disparity, the linguistic equity is being violated so much. This is wrong, right? So transparency. The second one, and this is my only magic bullet that I it's so important that I violate my own rule, is right now, ads are priced partially based on quality, right? So high quality ads are cheaper, and quality is defined by the ability to get a reaction. So you get a like, a comment, a reshare, someone forwards it in a message. But Facebook's own research has said over and over again that the shortest path to a click is hate, it's anger. And so it ends up playing out that angry, polarizing, divisive ads are 5 to 10 times cheaper than compassionate or empathetic ads. Because the reality is, I've heard the saying, a really good compromise usually leaves everyone a little dissatisfied, right? Everyone's a little unhappy with whatever good compromise happens. Guess what? You're not gonna click on that. And so there's this question of, if we value our democracies, we have to have flat ad rates, because I don't think there's a way we can remove that bias from the current system. So I'm not someone who says no political ads, but I am someone who says we have to remove the subsidy for extremism, the subsidy for polarization from the system. So those are my two like magic bullet immediate things. But yeah. I have other things that I'm working on, like around duty of care and like building consensus around what is that definition for a variety of problems. But that's like a slightly more holistic, like slightly longer term thing.
Say a few words about duty of care. Is that related to sort of like product safety? Is there a need for product safety style interventions here?
So there are publicly now a number of class action lawsuits that are underway. One of the things that needs to be established for us to say Facebook was negligent is for us as a community to establish what is a reasonable expectation of safety, right? Facebook has known that no one gets to see behind the curtain. You know, like you're saying before, it's hard to do these existence proof things where it's like, I don't know what could be there. So I don't know what questions to ask. I don't know if you're lying to me, right? And we need to come together and like, you know, let's just start with kids, right? So for kids, but one of those buckets is going to be, how do you actually keep people under the age of 13 off these systems? Facebook bragged in its Senate testimony right after mine that they had blocked 600,000 under 13-year-old accounts last year, or the year before, 2 years ago. But Facebook also has documents that show that 20% of 11-year-olds were on Facebook for certain cohorts. I assume the same is true for Instagram, right? We should have a conversation on what is a reasonable level of rigor for keeping kids off the platforms, right? So we need to step in there and like kind of break down what are the levers on each of these problems and then say, you know, what is feasible and what is reasonable? And then from that, we can take one step over after we've built consensus on that and say, what data would we need them to publish for us to know whether or not they were meeting the duty of care? And so that's the thing I want to work on a lot in the next year, along with stuff around how do we teach data science and how do we teach these issues? Because I want to do a bunch about simulated social networks.
Oh, fantastic. We should have an ongoing conversation about that.
Oh, yeah. Love to.
Are you, you know, a lot of people, you know, one thing that has sort of poked up in this conversation a couple of times is this notion of the business model, right? The idea that the engagement-based attention economy business model, where the business of Facebook is to get and keep your attention and then to sell that attention to advertisers, and that leads to, you know, things that lead. For journalists, if it bleeds, it leads. And for Facebook, as you describe, things that are engaging, and as well, you've described the subsidy very eloquently. When people recognize the business model contribution to the situation that we're faced with now, some people say, you know, we need to ban that business model. Do you go that far? Do you think, I assume you think that's part of the problem, but how much of that needs to be part of the solution? Is it a, you know, some people have very dramatic thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm. I know this is a topic that elicits a lot of emotion from people. I feel pretty strongly about not having targeted ads on people under the age of 16. Just because we have seen it really grossly abused with regard to eating disorders and a number of other similar issues. So things like targeting weight loss lollipops at kids who, you know, are going through physical changes. You know, I think it means that kids can't choose to walk away. Like you could unfriend all the things that were triggering you and you still won't be able to escape. I think the answer is very clean for under 16. Above that, I don't feel like I'm enough of an expert to really weigh in on it. Like I have only worked in ads for a year at the beginning of my career. And I think people deserve a right to choose. So I do think you should be able to turn off targeted ads anytime you want to. Because like there is a thing of it's the same kind of situation. But beyond that, I don't really feel qualified to weigh in.
Yeah. I got to tell you, that I think is, and I've said this on live television, that I think is part of what makes you so credible. I've seen you testify on that question of ads and say, I'm not qualified to answer that. And I actually think that that really is a big part of what makes you so credible, in addition to your background and expertise and experience inside these companies and so on. You know, the fact that you do not overstep your qualifications and you say, here's what I'm qualified to talk about, here's what I'm less qualified to talk about. I think that's a really big part of your credibility. Yeah, absolutely. I want to end with a question that I have to ask. We're obviously in the middle of.
I have one more thing I am qualified on. I really, really am against, I'm really against allowing to target audience-based ads. So most people don't know this. someone can choose to send just you an ad, right? As long as they throw in 99 random other people in, they can target you, you specifically with an ad. And when I worked on narrowcast misinformation, so this is like targeted misinformation, I ran an analysis looking at concentration of political ads, like who got shown the most political ads by geography. And the 99th percentile for people exposed to political ads in Washington, D.C. is not like twice as high as the median state in the United States, right? So we're talking about like 99th percentile in whatever median state is USA versus Washington, D.C. It's not like a 2x difference. It's like a 10 or like a 40x difference. Like it's a huge difference. And I can only imagine that's happening because it's believed that there's at least some subset of people in D.C. that are considered so valuable they are being specifically targeted. And so I'm very, very against that in terms of the targeting of ads. But that's just one of those things I think we need more awareness on, because I don't think our political leaders are actually being protected enough right now.
Great point. Thank you for that. So final question. We're obviously in the middle of a war in Europe, in the nation of Ukraine. I opened my book, The Hype Machine, with the story, the inside story of the annexation of Crimea, because we actually had data about Russian misinformation during the annexation of Crimea. I kind of feel that the social media companies are better prepared now than they were in Crimea or in Georgia in 2008. What do you see as social media's role in the geopolitical landscape, in war, in geopolitical? You started with a couple of those examples, but maybe specifically about Ukraine. What could they be doing better? What could they be doing better?
So I think it's really important for us to differentiate. This is actually one of these topics that I think we need to talk more about. So it's very easy to look at a situation like Ukraine and be like, oh my God, Russia today is still on Facebook, right? That's a reasonable emotional response, because when people looked at what was happening in Ukraine, things were going off the rails, right? But the real issue is that both Ukraine and Russia had been investing for years in these huge extensive networks of fake accounts, of bots, of fake pages that seemed like they were either Ukrainian or Russian groups, networks of amplification, many of which laid dormant for a long time. And the thing that the public needs to understand is that Facebook has the technology to easily detect coordination, but there is always a step before they take those things down, which is a human reviews it. Right? Because it's like sometimes people have invested a lot of energy in these groups. Like it's really important to be thoughtful on this. But Facebook underinvests in the teams that evaluate those results, right? When I worked on the threat intelligence team at Facebook, this was my last team when I was at Facebook. So I was there for about 8 months. I worked on counter espionage, which is the sister team to the information operations team. So these are the people who take the outputs of those systems and say, hey, this is like a giant Russian network. Though that team had less than 20 people on it. Like my team had, you know, 6 or 7 people on it. At any given time,
global.
Yeah.
Global. Wow.
Yeah. And it's amazing, because when I said that publicly and Facebook came out and they're like, we have 200 people. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. You have 10x what I said. But we don't know, because we have no transparency. And when I talk to governments around the world, this is a recurrent thing where people say, like, we ask for really basic questions about safety investments, and Facebook gives us nothing. And so one of the things everyone needs to understand is, like, Facebook could put out a feed like Twitter does, where they say any post that's viewed by more than 100,000 people, that needs to be public, needs to be available for researchers, because immediately we would find lots of information networks. Because remember, these are just lying in wait. The MIT Tech Review did a really good article last fall that was on the idea that there are a lot of these interest pages in the United States. So something like 13 of the top 15 evangelical interest pages in the United States were clearly trolls. They were clearly not evangelical Christians. You know, there were people in other parts of the world. They were synthetic pages. Or like for African Americans, it was like 9 of the top 15. Right? These things exist because Facebook allows them to continue to exist. And when Facebook goes into crisis mode, I guarantee you they shifted the information operations team out of Taiwan, out of looking after the United States, out of protecting the French election, and they put it on Ukraine. I'm sure that's what happened. Yeah. And it's one of these things where if you fight fires last minute, the wildfire will burn much hotter, much wider, much brighter. And we need to be investing more in a transparent way on an ongoing basis if we want to be safe, because this will happen again and again going forward.
So you're saying that if, for example, they commit more resources to Ukraine, watch out for the places where we're not looking for flare-ups. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Francis, I sincerely appreciate you joining us today. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
The Digital Insider with Sanaa Narel is brought to you by the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. Hosted by Sanaa Narel, produced and edited by Carrie Reynolds. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Share today's episode and tag us on social media at MIT_IDE. To leave a voicemail for Sanaa for the chance to have your question answered live on air in a future episode, call 617-468-8423, or you can email mitdigitalinsider@gmail.com. Visit our website, ide.mit.edu/podcast, for more.